The death of Robin Williams has turned up the spotlight on suicide and suicide prevention. This hour, how well the media deals with this sensitive subject. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Sociologist Kathy Beck Cross is with us from Grandview University in Des Moines to offer a media critique of the Williams news coverage. Also, the view of an Iowan who lost a family member to suicide. And we'll talk with the director of the University of Iowa Counseling Service about how the UI is training faculty, students, and members of the community to reach out to those who need help. Conversation. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The death of Robin Williams has turned up the spotlight on suicide and suicide prevention. That's what we're going to talk about this hour. In a few minutes, we'll talk with an Iowan who lost a family member to suicide. Also later, we'll talk with the director of the University of Iowa Counseling Service about how the UI is training faculty, students, members of the community to reach out to those who need help. But first, I want to look at how the media deals with this sensitive subject and also something called postvention. Kathy Beck Cross is with us, assistant professor of social work at Grandview University in Des Moines in our Des Moines studio. Hello, Kathy.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing fine. Let's get a little bit of your background out here so that we can know a little bit about your expertise and your experience here. You worked at an Iowa high school as a director of the Family Resource Center, and you developed and carried out some crisis response and suicide postvention and prevention activities after a series of suicides at that high school. And we're not going to name the high school. It got a lot of attention when it was in the news there. We want to learn from their experiences. Anything to add to that, Kathy?
Sure. I think the word postvention is unfamiliar to a lot of people.
Right.
They think of prevention and they think of intervention. And postvention are those activities that occur after a crisis, in this case, a suicide. And postvention is considered prevention because the kinds of activities and the way it's handled after a suicide can have a dramatic effect on whether or not they're likely to be copycat or contagion suicides.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so take us back. Before we talk about this past week and Robin Williams, talk about your experiences at that high school and how that fits in with postvention.
Sure. In my role at that high school, one of the things I was responsible for is crisis response after a situation had occurred. And there was a year where we had four suicides in a seven-month period. And unfortunately, we had the opportunity to practice our postvention activities over and over. And that experience really changed me personally. When I went back to school to work on my doctorate, I conducted research on the risk and protective factors related to adolescent male suicide and discovered some pretty interesting things related to what kinds of factors contribute to the likelihood of suicide, as well as develop some suggestions for how to provide prevention activities. And I'm currently a professor at Grandview University in social work.
Okay. So talk a little bit about that. Were these four suicides all males?
Yes, they were all males.
What happened to, I assume, one triggering the other to a certain extent? What was going on? What has your education since then in the predictors for males in this situation told you about what happened then?
Well, one of the difficulties is that it is not absolutely possible to indicate that one contributed to the other. When you look at contagion or copycat suicide, that really can only be examined after the fact, and then it's people's best guess and surmise about whether or not they
because
were related.
Because there are just so many factors in any given suicide, aren't there?
Yes, and then that's one of the things that I think when information comes out in the media that is difficult. Oftentimes, a very simple reason for a person's suicide is presented as the reason that the person carried out the attempt. And suicide is not simple. Suicide is a very complex situation and a very complex response to typically a variety of serious situations in a person's life.
Mm-hmm. What did you find? You said there were some very interesting things you found out. What were some of those things?
in terms of the research as to what contributes to adolescent suicide, we often think of mental health concerns. And that certainly is an important thing to consider, because 90% of people who die by suicide, if one conducted a psychological autopsy after their death, would be considered to have had a mental health or a substance abuse issue. However, I didn't examine that because the role of mental health and substance abuse has been looked at quite a bit. What I looked at a little bit more closely was the role of the family, the role of the community, and the role of the school, as well as some factors in the individual that have to do with the likelihood of resiliency.
Mm-hmm. And what conclusions did you come up with?
Well, when a young person has that feeling of self-determination, that expectation that when they have problems, they can deal with them in a way that will be successful, when they work hard in life, they'll find better things for their future, when they accept responsibility for their lives, when they have an increased level of self-determination as measured by those particular items, they are less likely to have a suicide intent, which has to do with either a plan or a thought of suicide, and they're less likely to have attempts. And so that really has some pretty serious implications for what we do in prevention. That means we need to teach young people how to problem solve situations, and we need to teach them that early and often. It helps if we start teaching them about how to problem solve situations when they're very young and the situations are relatively simple. That way they have practice under their belt when they mature and the situations become much more complex.
You've just joined us. Kathy Beck-Cross is my guest for this portion of the hour, assistant professor of social work at Grandview University in Des Moines. It's a lot of expertise in studying prevention of suicide, also something we've been talking about, postvention, when a suicide happens, how to stop what is very much like a contagion, a suicide contagion. And we want to mention a few times this hour, make sure that the National Suicide Prevention Hotline is posted with the posting of this show on our website and our Facebook page. But I'll mention it here, 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. Or you can go to the website, iowacrisischat.org, for anyone with questions or feelings that they want to explore. Kathy, let's talk a little bit about this case this past week, Robin Williams, the coverage of that. What have been your observations? I don't know how much media you've consumed about it.
Well, I've noticed enough to be concerned. And one of the things I'm specifically concerned about is the level of detail that's provided about the circumstances related to his death. That is one of the aspects that is considered not a best practice in media response. It's certainly not something that Iowa Public Radio has chimed in on, but other media outlets have begun to tell far too many details. And the difficulty with that is that in a situation where the story explicitly describes a suicide method, uses dramatic language or images, and has repeated or extensive coverage, what that does is it glamorizes the death and it sensationalizes the death. And people who are vulnerable anyway can see that as perhaps a role model for how they could handle their own situation, as well as perhaps a belief that if I do kill myself, then at least after I'm gone, people will really miss me and they'll see the error of their ways.
Mm-hmm. Might there be any reasons you can think of to reveal details about Robin Williams' death or any other suicide past that it was a suicide, more detailed than that?
No, I really don't think that there is a reason to tell a little bit more. And let's use an analogy of somebody dying by a heart attack. If somebody died by a heart attack, we would not provide explicit details of what they look like when they were found, the kind of details that talk about or the kinds of details that really could be traumatic for people listening. However, sometimes the media presents those kinds of details with a suicide. And I know people are curious. It's something they don't understand. They want to know what to look for and what to be concerned about. But those kinds of details are really harmful. They can bring up trauma in people who are vulnerable anyway.
Mm-hmm. What, for instance, the people who have had suicide, that tragedy strike their family, what effects can that type of coverage have on suicide loss survivors?
It can really add to the stigma. One of the difficulties for people who have had suicide attempts is very often they have mental health concerns. And in our country and in much of the world, mental health is an area that carries a great deal of stigma. And so very often family members can't talk about their loved one's suicide or mental health concerns because of that stigma. And when we sensationalize suicide, when we use inflammatory language, when we make it a very dramatic situation, that further stigmatizes the surviving family members.
Sensationalizing it in order to get more ratings, get more newspapers or hits on your website, I assume.
Sure. And some of it is inadvertent. I mean, there's the use of language, and we're all pretty cognizant of being politically correct and using language that is not inflammatory. And we're pretty well practiced at not using inflammatory language as it comes to refers to race or disability or gender. However, we're not quite as practiced at not using inflammatory language when it comes to having somebody who has died by suicide.
Right. And let's take that phrase right there, died by suicide. You're using it. Now, we grew up with a different phrase that used the word committed. And some might say, well, why can't you say that anymore? What is so bad about that? So explain that to us,
sure.
Kathy.
Well, what do people commit? They commit crimes. They commit adultery. They commit sins. And all three of those carry such strong and negative connotations that it can be really difficult for family members to have that association with that negativity. Died by suicide or completed suicide are a much more appropriate use of language. And who do we ask when we decide what kind of language we use? Well, we ask those affected, just like we ask people of various races, what kind of language they would prefer. We let women choose the language for how they are referred to. We let men use their language for how they are referred to. We let people with disabilities choose the language for how they'd like to be referred to. So the movement to use language that's less stigmatizing really came out of people who are survivors.
Mm-hmm. What do you consider to be helpful quality information when reporting on a suicide?
Sure. The big three are, first of all, using the proper language and not being inflammatory and not providing that kind of detail that we've talked about. But in reporting by the media, it's a wonderful opportunity for two pieces of information. One is accurate information on the signs and symptoms of suicide. There are lots of myths out there about suicide, but it's a wonderful opportunity to be able to tell people what they really can be looking for, both in themselves and in people that they care about. The other thing that the media can do after suicide is talk about access. Where does one go in order to get treatment for suicide or depression or substance abuse or other issues that are contributing to the person feeling suicidal?
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the Robin Williams case, highlighting some of the things that we're talking about today. Actually, the reason we're doing this show is you could say a benefit that you can pull some silver lining out of this dark cloud, the death of Robin Williams by suicide. The fact that we're trying to raise awareness about prevention and some of the many factors that go into a situation where this arises. What else did you see on the web or elsewhere in connection with Robin Williams' death? I guess I'm specifically talking about a genie meme.
I didn't actually see that, but I have heard about that. And when I was first told about it, it absolutely gave me chills because that's using a childhood character to talk about suicide in a way that really does seem to make it glamorous and interesting. And when we talk about suicide, I think about that old saying about just the facts, ma'am. We really need to be talking about just the facts related to suicide. What does it look like? What can you do? And not attach the emotion and perhaps glorification related to a children's cartoon.
Mm-hmm. So what are your takeaways from this media coverage? The good that can come out of a high-profile suicide is the fact that we're having a conversation like this, and perhaps somebody will hear it. And later on in the hour, we're going to be talking with some other people and talk a little bit more about what to do if you think somebody in your circle of friends, your family, may be at risk, right?
Right. And it's a wonderful opportunity when there is discussion about the signs and symptoms and what one can do about suicide after a celebrity death. That means millions of people across the country are able to get information that can be very helpful. It also means that they can get information that can be very harmful. And there's some history behind that. In 1962, when Marilyn Monroe died, her list of the probable cause of her death was listed as suicide. And after that inflammatory media coverage, the suicide rate in the U.S. jumped by 12% compared with the same months in the previous year.
What is the thought as to why that one?
Well, just what we've been talking about. When there is a great deal of coverage and glorification and information about the means and those kinds of details, somebody who identified with her could see that as a way perhaps to connect and see that as a role model for how to manage personal problems.
Mm-hmm. And just to make sure that people had this genie picture in their mind that was very unhelpful was the genie from Aladdin, which mm-hmm. Robin Williams played the voice of in that Disney. And then the genie was portrayed there, and I think some words as to, genie, you're free. Mm-hmm. And that's mm-hmm. very much a glorification of what you were talking about.
Absolutely, because what that doesn't take into consideration is the people that are left behind to deal with the uncertainty and lack of understanding as to why that happened. And if you compare the situation with Marilyn Monroe to when Kurt Cobain died, and that was in 1994, in the months that followed, his family reached out and spoke with the media and talked about how very, very difficult it was. And they asked the media not to report on it in quite the same way. And conversely, as compared to the Marilyn Monroe situation, after he died, in the months afterwards, the number of calls to the suicide prevention line in Seattle surged, and then suicides actually went down. Mm-hmm. So when healthy information is provided after suicide, it can provide people with information about what to do, where to go, and what to watch out
for. So this is what you're saying also. This is not just theory. This is practice. We have contrasting situations where one was glorified, sensationalized, and it in many cases led to this contagion, and in other cases where it led to a chance to raise awareness.
Right, right. And in sociology, we know that if you incite fear in somebody without providing them with accurate information about what to do, it just makes the situation worse.
Okay. Joining us, Kathy Beck Cross, Assistant Professor of Social Work at Grandview University in Des Moines. She worked at an Iowa high school as director of the Family Resource Center a few years ago when there was a crisis there. There were four suicides, I think, in the course of 7 months. And Kathy has been making that, I guess, your mission, your calling to look at postvention prevention of suicide. Join our conversation. Has your family been touched by suicide? What have been your thoughts and concerns as you've watched, listened to the coverage of Robin mm-hmm. Williams' death? 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org is our email. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Joining Kathy and me now is Sue. Sue is an Iowan from Sioux City who lost her mother to suicide in 2005, and Sue prefers we only use her first name. We want to respect that, of course. Sue, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
And I'm very sorry for your loss, and I want to thank you especially for having the courage to come on this show to talk about it in the hopes that we can better understand and prevent suicide. So thank you, Sue.
Thank you.
What can you tell us about your mother's struggles before her suicide?
Well, she did suffer from clinical depression. She had been taking medication for it. She even went as far as had electroshock treatment done, which many people think does not happen anymore. She really did, you know, try her very best to get out of this black hole that was following her around for several years. She had had a problem with alcohol, but she had been sober for 2 years after when this happened.
Mm-hmm. Share with us what you can and what you feel is appropriate about the day she took her life and the effect that had on your family.
Well, of course, it was devastating. That day, I'd actually thought about calling her, and I didn't. I was at work, and I got the call, you know, later from my uncle who had called for my dad. So I wasn't there. They live in Wisconsin. apparently, you know, she had gotten up, she had taken her medication for the day, which doesn't seem, you know, like, why would you do that if you had that decision made already? But she did walk into our my family's kitchen and took her life. My father was outside and had heard something, but didn't really think a lot of it. And then probably 10 minutes later went into the house to find her.
Mm-hmm. What happened after that? How did your family cope with this? How does a family cope with that?
Well, I don't live, my brother and father live in the same town, and I live in Iowa, so I'm ways away. So it was hard to deal with it together. Of course, we all came together at the time when I got home. You know, it was tough, but I knew that I had to talk about it, so I sought out a group, which was called Broken Silence here in Sioux City, and it was very helpful. My dad did the same thing. My brother did not. But both of us went through groups. I went through, actually, the group here twice. The first time was just a little hard for me to take in everything. Second time, I got a lot more out of it. Just the things that she would have us do, writing letters, bringing pictures and memories, and talking about spirituality and things like that.
So it was really the talk that you needed most. You needed to share things. And isn't it true that, Sue, and I don't know how it was with your friends and acquaintances, that people don't know, friends and acquaintances often don't know how to deal with someone who's been affected in their family by suicide. Did you find people clamming up, uncomfortable with you?
Oh, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, one of the girls that worked for me, and we were kind of friends, she had called me when I was up in Wisconsin, and she was hoping, she told me later, she was hoping that you didn't answer because I didn't know what to say, but I answered my cell phone. And, you know, I'll never forget that, though, because it's, you know, she had the guts to call. Mm-hmm. And that's really what people want. They just want you to be able to, you know, let you know that somebody's out there thinking about you.
When someone calls, though, they want to know what to say. So what is there a, I don't want to be glib about it, a one-size-fits-all way to approach this?
No, there isn't. Obviously, I guess it's just, there's really not much you can say except, of course, I'm sorry. But, you know, just letting them talk, I think just letting me talk, because I'm not going to talk about that unless somebody were probably to come up and make me feel like I could talk to them. So I think just being a friend to somebody mm-hmm. and letting them talk as much as they want or as little as they want in the amount of time that they need, because, you know, everyone's different in that time. The time frame is just varies. And some people might talk about it sooner, some may later. But I think just being a friend and being that comfortable person that somebody could go to you and say, you know, this is how I'm feeling today.
Listening.
Exactly. Mm.
Please stay with us, Sue. And again, thank you so much for joining us this hour. Sue from Sioux City lost her mother to suicide. And she's sharing those experiences so that we can better understand and prevent suicide this hour. Also with Kathy Beck Cross, Assistant Professor of Social Work at Grandview University in Des Moines. She worked at an Iowa high school as the director of the Family Resource Center and had to have some crisis response when there was a series of suicides at that high school. You can join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, especially if your family's been touched by suicide. What are your thoughts? What are your concerns? What do you want to tell us about how we best deal with this and prevent a contagion, a suicide contagion, for instance? 1-866-780-9100. When we come back, we'll also be joined by Sam Cochran, director of the University of Iowa Counseling Service. It's River to River. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking this hour about suicide prevention and postvention. That's a word I didn't know about before preparing for this show. What's best practices? What should be done after a suicide to prevent, for instance, a suicide contagion where you have a series of suicides? We're talking also about how well our news media reports on suicide, good do's and don'ts there, and how to best help those in our lives we may feel are at risk. Kathy Beck Cross is with us, sociologist at Grandview University in Des Moines. A lot of expertise and personal experience in dealing with suicide prevention and postvention. Sue is with us Sue is an Iowan who lost her mother to suicide in 2005. Join our conversation at 1-866-780-9100. We have a number of calls. Let's go to Jill, first of all. Jill calling from Des Moines. Hello, Jill.
Hi there.
Hi there. What's your connection to our conversation today?
I've had three suicides in my immediate family. My maternal grandmother killed herself after giving birth to my mom, and my father killed himself when I was a teenager, and then his father killed himself.
I'm so sorry to hear about that.
Well, thank you. It's taken me a lifetime of still unfolding different ways that I can deal with it as I age. Different factors kind of become, I mean, losing a parent, and so as you age, the different ways that plays out when you have your own children. One thing I've really tried very hard to do is talk with both my own children about heredity, neurological wiring, risk factors with depression, and I also worked 20 years in public schools with gifted, talented kids, and so, you know, I think being very sensitive to how to talk with children who are going through existential angst and trying to find their purpose in life, feeling overwhelmed about animal extinction, climate change, wars, you know, what are some ways to deal with these things with kids that are sensitive and intellectually really at very young ages.
I can imagine that those were very, the initial conversations were very difficult to have with your kids. Has it become something that's easier to talk about?
It's actually something we refer to fairly frequently. We all struggle with seasonal affective disorder hugely, and I actually, when my kids started college, I needed to go on finally on antidepressant medication because I kind of hit a rock bottom where I wasn't eating. And so I talk with them a lot about, you know, ways to deal with anxiety and other things. I've had EMDR therapy, so I want to mention that as something that can be used even with very young children.
EMDR, can you give us a quick brief on
right.
that?
It's an eye movement therapy that, and sometimes also can be used with buzzers in the hand. Either your eyes are moving or your hands are having a left-right kind of a buzzing process that brings together kind of the both sides of the sides of the brain is a very simplistic way to say it, but it brings emotions to the surface. And with combined with discussion therapy with EMDR-trained therapists is very effective. It was developed for Vietnam vets initially, and as I said, it can be used with very young children. So I would recommend anybody to Google EMDR for depression in general, you know, post-traumatic stress and depression and grief. Also talking with children about getting out in nature, of course, light related to seasonal affective disorder, exercise, you know, expression of your fears, concerns, anxiety, and that some people do need meds. And so my children and I, who are now 28 and 30, have very open discussions about whether I am on meds or not, because when I have gone off a few times, it has really been overwhelming for me. And I take a light dose in the summer, but we all struggle in the winter.
Jill, thank you. We have a number of callers and some other guests here. Jill, thank you so much. So much experience and wisdom packed into what Jill said there.
Thank you.
Kathy Beck-Cross, you've dealt with young people, of course, in the high school where you were working. Anything to add to what Jill said?
Well, first of all, I just want to say I applaud Jill for talking about this openly with her children. That helps decrease the stigma. As long as we talk about things, we keep that conversation going, and we recognize that it's okay to talk about the kinds of things that are happening in our lives and how to watch out for each other. I thought it was interesting that she mentioned having worked with talented and gifted children, and one of the warning signs of suicide among all ages is a level of perfectionism. And that is one of the things that was widely discussed at the school district where I worked, is watching out for those young people who are perfectionists. But the warning sign of perfectionism is not just for young people.
Kathy Beck-Cross, Sue is with us as well. Let's welcome Sam Cochran into our conversation by phone, director of the University Counseling Service at the University of Iowa. Sam Cochran, welcome.
Thanks, Ben. I'm really glad to be on the line here with you all.
And you've been listening into the conversation up to this point. Tell us about college students. How serious is the problem of suicide among college students?
Well, about 1,100 college and university students a year commit suicide. My belief is it's particularly tragic since it's mostly young people who have a full lifetime ahead of them. I also think that as a campus community, there are many things that we can do, which we're working on to increase awareness, recognize vulnerabilities, and be able to reach out and connect with these college students to try and head off that downward spiral into depression and vulnerability to suicide that so frequently is kind of the combination of depression and hopelessness that leads to a suicidal thought or impulse.
Mm-hmm. Sam, before you go further, I do want to throw out the National Suicide Prevention line, 1-800-273-8255. Or iowacrisischat.org is a web thing. And maybe, Sam, you can tell us who should be calling that number.
Well, I think anyone who may have a thought of self-harm, of suicide, a thought of death, maybe it would just be better if I wasn't here. If you've actually gone so far as to make a plan or begin to develop the means to collect the means to carry out that plan, don't hesitate. Get help, please. Good help is available in the form of proven psychotherapies and medications. There is an extensive array of services available in all our communities that are willing and ready and stand able to help people who are struggling with depression, suicidal thoughts, suicidal impulses. Don't hesitate. That's one of the biggest messages, is that help is available. People recover. Prevention works, treatment works.
Sam Cochran, we want to go back to the phones in just a moment, but tell us a little bit about, more specifically, what's been going on at the University of Iowa recently. You have a new program?
I am the privileged to be the director of a 3-year federally funded suicide prevention grant for college and university students that the University of Iowa landed just 2 years ago. We're entering our third year. The purpose of the grant is to bring together campus and community partners to do just what the caller from Des Moines, I believe it was Des Moines a few minutes ago, said, to raise awareness of vulnerabilities, risk factors, warning signs, not just in a few of the professionals, but among all people on campus, and then to deliver gatekeeper training, which is a set of knowledge, skills, and abilities for all people on campus to be able to recognize a student in distress and to reach out and connect with them, refer them to help resources, let them know that someone cares, that they're not alone, that they don't need to feel helpless, and that help is available and that they should seek help. One of the best things I think we can do is kind of move upstream, so to speak, and try and reach students before they reach the depths of despair and hopelessness that often leads to suicide.
1-866-780-9100. Sam, please stand by. We want to talk to Mary in Des Moines. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Tell us your connection to our conversation today.
Well, I've attempted suicide 3 times, and I found that family and friends, and even some psychiatrists and therapists, when you have experienced the attempt, are afraid to talk about it. And I think they really need to acknowledge to the individual just what a terrible struggle and turmoil that the individual was experiencing. Mm-hmm. That caused the attempt, and a lot of times it's after a long period of trying several different things, and so I feel that's really important. And I was hospitalized, and that brings me to funding for mental health in general, and I think we all can take a more active part in funding mental health community services. I know Des Moines lost their Franklin Center for Adults, which put 4,000 individuals out of therapy. And I'd just like to say that psychotherapy and medication have been extremely beneficial for me, as well as sometimes the extended hospitalization that I went through had really saved my life.
Mary, we're so glad that worked for you. Mary in Des Moines, thank you for sharing your experiences. Sam Cochran, let's pick up on the point that she made initially, that our impulse often as human beings is to pull away,
exactly.
not to pry, to ignore,
exactly.
to deny,
exactly.
perhaps. Why is that not a good avenue to go down?
Well, I think Mary is precisely correct. She makes a very important point about how important it is to connect with the person who appears to be struggling and going down, and to talk about it, to ask the question, have you thought about suicide? Are you thinking about killing yourself? That paradoxically often will relieve the despair because the person recognizes there is someone else who gets it. Mm-hmm. They understand what despair I'm in.
You don't need to couch it in any fancy language or dance around it. You acted as directly as you just did.
Yes, directly as you just did. There's the myth out there that somehow if you ask that question directly, you'll implant the idea in the person's mind. Nothing could be further from the truth. They're already there. And by bringing that up and putting it on the surface, you actually connect with the person. And that's such a lifesaver.
Okay. Mary, once again, thank you for your call from Des Moines. Let's go to Sherry in Des Moines. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks to all your guests for sharing their expertise and experience. My question relates to something that Sue said earlier, and that was that her mother had electric shock treatments of some kind that are no longer used. I am close with a person who deals with very serious depression, and her psychiatrist has recommended a more current version of that. And I'm wondering if any of you know anything about that. It is considered electroshock therapy.
Sherry, I'm afraid we're going to have problems with that unless somebody diagnosing over the air is just not a good practice for us. What could we encourage her to do, Sam?
Well, encourage Mary to do?
Well, Sherry is talking about different electrical shock therapy. Consult a primary care physician, first of all.
Primary care or psychiatrist, the electroshock therapy has come a long way since the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and it is used for the most intractable, severe, apparently kind of what they call treatment refractory depression. So I'm not an MD or a psychiatrist, but it is an approved and beneficial medical treatment for some forms of depression. So I would ask a primary care or a mental health psychiatrist about it.
Okay. Thank you for that call.
Yeah.
Lena, are you there from the Quad Cities?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Hello, Lena. Thank you for joining our conversation. Tell us what your connection is.
I lost my sister in November 2012 to suicide.
I'm sorry.
Thank you so much. What I found, and I guess what I want to say today, is that the questions I was left with seem to be very different from the same types of questions people had who lost loved ones in a car accident or to a terminal illness. The questions were so much more complex that I found that the people I could connect the most to were other people who had lost loved ones to suicide. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. in my immediate area, I didn't know that many people, so I went online and found a great online community and able to, in my dark moments, post to my group questions, concerns, ways to get, you know, if I couldn't sleep, what I could do to try to calm down and have this immediate feedback right away from an online support group. And again, traditional methods of dealing with grief didn't work for me, but speaking to others who had experienced lost to suicide, specifically who had lost their siblings to suicide, that for me was the most beneficial.
Lena, thank you for sharing that. Sue, your mother died from suicide in 2005. That is your experience, too. You sought out support, you wanted to talk, and you wanted to talk with people who had similar situations, correct?
Correct, because they know what you're going through.
Mm-hmm. There is this question, too, of that always comes up, and I know it came up with the Robin Williams suicide. The question of how could you do that to your family? Mm-hmm. How do we, Kathy Beck Cross? Perhaps I can go back to you on that. What are we not understanding when we ask that question, or are we understanding something?
I think when we ask that question, we're obviously thinking about it from our own perspective, and we don't realize the level of pain the person who is killing themselves is in. I know of a recent situation where a person killed himself, and right before he did so, the story that I'm told is that he said, for many reasons, this is wrong, but I feel like I don't have any other choice. And that's what I think it's inexplicable to those who are left behind. But for those who are carrying out the act, we have to think that they truly don't feel like there's any other choice in life. And perhaps they didn't feel like they could tell anybody. Perhaps they didn't know of options that were available to them, which circles us all the way back around to what can we do to make people aware of what the signs and symptoms are and how do we access services. And that certainly fits in with the work that Sam's doing in Iowa City.
Mm-hmm. Sam, perhaps you can pick up right there on cue because we've got about 5 minutes left of this conversation.
Sure.
What can we do? What can we do as individuals? A lot of ears out there with family members
Sure.
and friends who want to know what to do.
Right. Well, if you happen to be in the Iowa City, Coralville, kind of Johnson County area, you can enroll in some of the training opportunities that our grant is making available in the area. We have an array of training, mental health first aid, question, persuade, refer, or called QPR. We have an online gatekeeper training program. But I believe these programs are probably available in most communities. So educating yourself about the warning signs, the risk factors. And then I believe someone mentioned before, if you notice a family member, a friend, a loved one, and a neighbor, a student who is distressed, and most of us know what that looks like, don't pull away. Reach out. Connect. Touch. Simply ask, how are you doing? Would it help to talk with someone? Have you thought about killing yourself if you think it's at that level of despair? And encourage the person to get help. There's help available. Treatments work. And that's what saves lives.
And if they turn away, if you don't get an open response, what do you do then, Sam?
Well, it's very much dependent on the specific situation, but you can persist. It could be that you want to just pull back and let that person settle down a bit and then reapproach them and try and connect with them. If it seems like the person is in immediate danger, you can always call an ambulance or a law enforcement person who does have more leverage, quote unquote, in terms of getting a person who is a risk to themselves or others into a safe environment, whether that be an emergency room or some other kind of setting that at least can provide a temporary protection. The training helps each individual work through those different decision trees and options about what to do if you're faced with ABC. So the training, I think, is one of the best things that we've got at our disposal to make sure that people know about.
Mm-hmm. Is there a place online, let's say you're outside of the area that you mentioned, people can start online. Where is a place to start? Or can you also call the suicide prevention line to get some tips there as well?
You can do both. The suicide prevention lines, both the National Lifeline that you mentioned, as well as the Johnson County Crisis Center line. And it's kind of a www address, but you can go online to the University of Iowa and Google suicide prevention or do a local site search for suicide prevention, and you will land on the University Counseling Service suicide prevention page. And that has the different training opportunities listed and how to enroll in them.
Okay, we've got just a minute or two left. I want to have Kathy, do you have any concluding thoughts here, something we didn't get to or something you want to reemphasize?
Sure. For those people who aren't able to access the information available to residents or nearby folks in Johnson County, almost everybody these days has access to the internet and the Suicide
yeah.
Prevention Resource Center, which
Great.
Is www.sprc.org, and the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, AFSP.org, both offer excellent information. And the SPRC actually has a place where you can enter information as to your role. Are you a teacher? Are you a parent? Are you a friend? Are you a colleague? And then the information will come up personalized for your role. All of us can take advantage of ways to begin to recognize those signs and symptoms.
Okay. I want to mention the National Suicide Prevention Line, 1-800-273-8255. Sue, again, thank you so much for joining us today. You lost your mother to suicide in 2005. What are the things you struggle with most still today?
Oh, probably those
things like Mother's Day, you know, holidays, things like that, when we would all be together. And you obviously miss that person very much.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sue, it sounds like you have a tremendous support group. You've sought that out, and that's what people need to do in your situation or a situation of a depressed person who is at risk. Sue, thank you once again for joining our conversation.
Thank you.
And also to you, Kathy Beck-Cross, Assistant Professor of Social Work at Grandview University in Des Moines. Thank you, Kathy.
Thanks. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this important public health issue.
Sam Cochran, thank you, Director of the University Counseling Service at the University of Iowa. We appreciate your expertise.
Thanks again, Ben, for being able to be a part of this important conversation. Thank you very much.
Tomorrow on this program, we'll find out why osteopathic medical schools across the country are seeing an uptick in interest. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. If you caught part of this program, you want to hear the entire program, we'll put it online for you as a podcast, or you can listen to it online. Go to iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.